Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. And welcome to Feed Your Head. I'm Miss Anna Martefio, and I'm very happy tonight to have Peter Cohen as my guest. Hello, Peter.
Hello. Good evening, Ruth Ann.
And you are in Brazil.
Correct.
So it's like, wow. I've wanted to go there ever since a friend of mine told me he flew down one time. And, you know, he could see the whole, like, east coast of Brazil at night. It was outlined because people were celebrating Yamaya.
Yes, exactly.
And they were, you know, sailing out the little candles and the watermelons and different things. He said that the coastline was lit up. And I said, I want to go.
Yeah, so. Very beautiful. There's very beautiful things like that, the festivals. And,
yeah.
I recommend it.
Now, you're not originally from Brazil, though.
No, I'm an American, born and raised in New York, traveled a lot after that, and here I am in Brazil now.
Yeah. Well, but, yeah, you're there, and now, thanks to the Internet, the Internet, we can do a lot of work with other people around the world. We don't have to just be face-to-face. Yeah. Tonight, we're
going
to talk about a new group. I have never seen anything take off like this has. I want to tell our listeners, you can find Peter on Facebook. There's two Peter Cohen. One is Peter the Man, it's his wall. The other Peter Cohen is the group. And then there's the H4P.
Correct.
Which is Humanity for Palestine. And you just, it's been 2 weeks and 2 days or something?
Exactly.
You started this group? My goodness. So many times, you know, things creep along. They go along at their own rate, on and on. But I guess it's because you have a different vision than, because those of us who are active for Palestine, we know, and we keep being added to groups all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for Palestine, and they're pretty redundant, a lot of them, and you can see that when so-and-so goes and posts a certain thing in 15 groups, but yet doesn't put it on his wall, his own wall, and it's like, well, okay, we're preaching to the choir, but what you're doing is different. Do you want to explain this idea?
Well, I really hear two questions in your question, so maybe I'll answer one and then the second. The first is about the genesis of this group, where it came from, and, you know, I see it part of something bigger. So we can take a quick look at that. There's very brief history. And two is this issue of, exactly, there were groups before this, and I was in plenty of them over the last few years, and I agree, this phenomenon you're talking about, people avoid talking about this issue with just anybody, it's sensitive, et cetera. So I think we can look at both of those separately and maybe start with the history.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Maybe I'll tell this. I don't know what the best way to do it is. I'll tell it from a personal point of view, my story. You know, I'm Jewish. I'm a Jewish New Yorker. I grew up in a mixed environment, all kinds of people, but a heavy... You know, I never counted percentages, but a lot of Jewish people in there, you know, very Jewish, but also very mixed. Yeah. And, you know, I grew up with the story of Israel that people like me grew up with, and a certain vision of Israel. I think, without getting too much into detail, I don't think until 2008 I really looked at the issue very closely. I never questioned it. It wasn't really on my radar. And the thing that sort of shook me was 2008, 2009, Operation Cast Lead.
Yes.
And I saw the tremendous, the devastating attack on Gaza, you know, would seem to be overkill, excessive use of force, tremendous civilian casualties, et cetera, all things that sound familiar to us now. But, you know, you see all of this and other things. And you started seeing that, for example, the media, the U.S. media. I was in Brazil at the time, Brazil, France, I was somewhere. And, you know, the story we were getting on the U.S. media and the story we were getting from other sources was not the same. So I think after the Iraq invasion and all of that, I think some of us were alerted to that we already knew that we couldn't trust our media to tell us everything.
Yeah.
And this was a very clear example of that. I'll give one. I think a real wake-up call was the bombing of the UN school.
Mm.
And, you know, I don't want to say this too bluntly, but, well, you know, the Israeli government pretty much lied.
Yeah.
You know, basically they told one story. It's very clear that that wasn't what happened. And so I think that these events really shook me into taking another look at this whole situation. And I don't think I was alone. I think there was a certain amount of awakening around this, Kathleen. The first thing I discovered Ilan Pappé, the Israeli historian, wonderful, brilliant man, and, you know, who has done incredible research on the history, on the untold history of Israel and Palestine. Then I discovered Gideon Levy, who is absolutely fantastic. I'm giving these names. I'm hoping that people will go, you know, look them up on YouTube, watch a video, look at their books, et cetera. Extraordinary. And Gideon Levy also writes a column in Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper. So I started to hear, I learned about the Shmini Steam, the conscientious objectors, Israeli, young Israelis who go to jail rather than serving in the occupation. And so I started to discover this other side of Israel. In other words, we talk about Israel as if it's a monolith, you know, Israel. You know, to criticize the politics of Netanyahu is to criticize Israel.
Exactly.
As if there's only one Israel, just like here. You know, some people hate Obama, some people love him, some people are indifferent, but that doesn't make us more or less American. We have a lot of different opinions. That's part of having a country and democracy. So, now moving on, I think after doing this research, this initial research, Gideon Levy and such, I was looking for an in. I wanted to go to Palestine and see it for myself. Through my work, I work in international development. It just so happened that an opportunity opened up. I grabbed it, and I went to Palestine. I was in 2011, 2012. I was there on four separate visits for a total of about 2 months. I was only surrounded by Palestinians, working with and for Palestinians. I was involved with Palestinians from, you know, government officials and mayors and ministry people, all the way down to drivers and falafel salesmen, and I was working with waste pickers on the dump, and so I was with the waste pickers. I really got a panorama of what was going on in East Jerusalem and West Bank. The IDF they refused my entry to Gaza, so I wasn't able to go there. And that experience was, it shook me. It was an eye-opening experience because I realized that, you know, I'm trying to use the nicer words, but lied to all my life.
Yeah.
Everything I had been told about the whole situation over there was completely wrong. That I was seeing images for the first time, and to me, maybe this will sound a little strong to you, but this was a personal impression that I had when I got there. I saw the towers and the walls and the barbed wire and all of that, and I thought, and I could see in my mind's eye the gates of Auschwitz, and I said to myself, why can I see these gates in my mind from 70 years ago, and yet I've never seen this, which is happening now. So that is the background. I guess I'm now telling my personal story, but I think it's a little bit everyone's story to the extent there was an awakening around Kathleen. It was small. But when the Gaza attack began, after the three teenagers, and et cetera, everything that's happened since June 12th, something new. This is a new stage in terms of global and U.S. awareness around this issue. And so that's where the story begins. Tell me if I'm talking too much.
Oh, no. You're making sense, and go, talk.
That brings us to the story of this group and the larger phenomenon that's part of. I think it's important not to see Humanity for Palestine as an isolated thing, as an anomaly. It's almost like I had my little boat, my little Facebook page, and all the boats around me were starting to rise, and so was mine. And there was a flood of connection that happened, of activity that started around June 12th, and that raised all of the boats, and that this is a direct consequence of that. So what do I mean? Well, people started to feel compelled to reach out, to search out reliable sources of information that they were not getting in the mainstream media.
Right.
They were compelled to find people who were giving good analysis, explaining what was going on in a way that made sense to them. They needed to talk about what they were seeing because they were upset. They needed to share their sentiments with other people who felt the same. So when you talk about preaching to the choir, yes, but it was also a kind of group therapy. People needed to connect around this. And it's so amazing what I heard again and again, and even today, at least three people said it to me, again and again, I feel so helpless. I feel so powerless.
Yes.
I can't do anything. I don't know what to do. And, you know, and as this phenomenon continued, and I was part of it, in other words, I felt the same, it sort of began to dawn on me that there were so many helpless, powerless people out there that we actually had a tremendous amount of power. Mm-hmm. And so the story now quickly of Humanity for Palestine, because it is a quick story, I would check back just for my own, you know, enlightenment, I checked back through my Facebook page, and on June 26th. So I was part of this rise of connectivity. A lot of people were friending me. I was friending people, et cetera. I was involved in other pages, and they were involved with me, et cetera. And on June 26th, I wrote a poem that I posted. And now, you know, I don't care about likes. I don't care about shares. I never really thought much about any of those things. But, you know, when I would post a picture of my daughter and get 50 likes, I would say, oh, you know, 50 likes. So people are, you know, people like this. Well, I got 350 shares of this poem. And that's when I realized that something was different. And I called it a state change. It was a completely different ball game. You know, it was an order of magnitude different.
Right.
And so that continued. Then, you know, I was then compelled to read and to learn and to exchange and to post and to discuss and to debate. And the connecting was getting bigger and bigger. And finally, literally days after that, I passed 1,000. I always had maybe 500 people on my Facebook page, and it crossed 1,000. Then people started demanding for me to make my page public. You know, they wanted to share, and they weren't able to share my posts. And I said, wait a second, you know, I got to do something about this. I've got pictures of my family. I mean, you know, this is a personal page, and I don't really want to make it public. I need to make a separation between my public and private space. And so I created this group and started sort of, you know, displacing people from my page, moving them all into this group so we could talk about Palestine in one space, and I could get my personal life back in the other. And that was a genesis. So that was August 3rd. So once we got this group together, we started discussing, what do we do now? What do we want this to look like? How, you know, and the first thing we did was 2 days later, we created working groups. So, you know, the idea was to break people up so that they could start working on things, actually do something.
Yes.
The idea was to move from talk to action, and you know, to take all of this energy and stop wasting it in posting and commenting. You know, I realize that there's a you know, there's a pull in Facebook to just talk, as if talk were a replacement for action.
Yeah.
And that rather than talking and sharing, what we need to do is plan actions and execute them. So that was the kind of basic vision. And we created the working groups. And then maybe a day or two later, we debated, we came up with a name, Humanity for Palestine. All of this came out of a sort of consensual debate, just anyone was around, and we discussed and we decided and went for it. Humanity for Palestine created a page. That was, I think, on the 6th. So here we are. What's the date? You know, it hasn't been a long time, but it feels like it feels like a long time. It's been about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's basically the idea. I would say that Humanity for Palestine is an incubator of action. It's an example of what I call global online citizens action. It's people trying to take action and to use these online formats, even the Facebook format, which is not made for action, and to tweak them into an action-oriented mode.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we are.
Well, and so now you've broken up into several working groups, actually.
Correct. Mm. Correct. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to say we also launched about the same time, I think it was on the 5th, we launched our page. So we do have, and please go to our Humanity for Palestine Facebook page, like it, check it out. It's going to be improving a lot in the very near future. We have a lot of new things coming on, you know, original content, big stuff coming. And we are hopefully going to move to a website in the near future. So, you know, it's going to keep changing. Yes, I'm sorry.
Well, it's evolving. And you have something that is not that common as far as people choosing. I mean, people do this sometimes in a physical, real life kind of thing. There's some kind of a convention, and people go off to, okay, I'm good with music, so I'm going off with these other musicians and kind of thing. But this is what you're doing. Do you want to talk about some of these groups and what
sure, absolutely.
You're up to? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, you know, the structure is organic and evolving, and it's changing even as we speak. We're actually in a kind of a restructuring right now. We're trying to make it more responsive to the members. We're trying to increase the workflow. Ideally, we want to make this a place where, because one of the things is people don't have time. I have a job. I happen to be a little bit off right now during the summer, but, I usually work full time.
Sure.
So we need... we need ways to put our energy that will have an impact. So the idea is this is a place where you can come and do what you want, when you can, knowing that it's plugging into something bigger and that it will be part of a larger action and that someone else will take over when you're, we're digging a ditch and you dig a few shovelfuls and somebody else will dig the next few. That is the model. So I'll tell you about the groups. We have the culture group, which is doing, again, I don't want to get too into actions that are underway.
No, that's fine.
You know, but stuff is really coming up fast. And culture deals with all kinds of cultural expression. It may involve musical recordings. It may involve concerts. It may involve the sale of Palestinian arts and crafts and other products. It may involve, basically, any type of cultural production or exchange, either by Palestinians or for Palestine. That is culture. We have action, which is focused on all forms of action, whatever they may be. It could be demonstrations. It could be, email or phone-in campaigns. Or it could be flash mobs. It could be, all types of action. That would be action. Then we have, we have giving, which is really about everything having to do with fundraising and charity donations, vetting organizations, finding out what are the best options, helping people sort through where they can give money and how, and making it easier. Or not just money, or support, or time,
yeah,
to helping people on the ground in Gaza, specifically in Palestine more generally. Then we also have... I'm not looking at them right now. Well, we're just starting a new one called communication, which is going to be everything from public awareness campaigns to things really involving children's education and you know, adult information. And we have one idea that we have that's been sort of kicking around from the beginning is a Mythbusters team. We want to be able to deploy people who can debunk a lot of these, you know, let's not get into it now, but, you know, we hear about tunnels and rockets. We hear about, I'm not saying there are no rockets, but the things we hear, you know, tunnels and the Hamas charter and so many things, you know, a lot of the information we're getting is distorted and, you know, incomplete,
yeah,
et cetera. So that's the idea, to be able to get people out there who are able to answer some of these, you know, some of these non-factual arguments. What have I forgotten? That's pretty much it for now, I think.
Okay.
Culture, action, communication, and giving. Those are our main ones. Then we have some structures around. We have the page, which is, so there's something very exciting which is coming on right now. I believe tomorrow it will be ready, is what we call the library. We have people around the clock, I mean, diligently working to create a tremendous searchable archive of information on Palestine. And so we're going to be sort of, you know, unveiling that very soon. And that's going to plug into everything else, so the library. And that's it. As I said, we have other, I think you'll be seeing us in other places soon on Twitter and website, et cetera, et cetera. And there you go.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is so different from so many of the groups that we see on Facebook, the groups and the pages that are for Palestine, because I'll see one person who posts, you know, one of the things I don't like about Facebook is the fact that people can ask groups you don't even know, and you end up in a lot of these groups, and I mean, I don't know because I can't
see
my notifications. You can only get 100 at a time, and I mean, you can only so I don't know. And then I'll see something come up, and I go check it out, and oh, I was added 3 months ago to this group. You know, this is a little thing with me with Facebook, but there's so many Palestinian groups, and the people all, I mean, they're wonderful people, but the groups are redundant. And
right, exactly.
So it's and they're preaching to the choir, because
they're
putting it on their own walls, where actually somebody who doesn't know may see. I know I've had people say, well, I don't like seeing those dead babies on your wall. Well, you know, that's the thing about Facebook. You can either block me or you can block whatever, you know, because I think, I mean, it's not that I like posting pictures of dead babies. People need to know. And
exactly.
So it's like, I'm not there to make friends. I want to get the word out. So
absolutely. You know this.
Go ahead.
No, you got me all excited. Yeah, I completely see where you're going. I feel the same way. And I do a range. You know, I talk to settlers. I have some settlers I'm friends with on Facebook. And, well, you know, I know one very interesting guy who's actually a settler in the West Bank. And then he has all of his friends, and some of them have views that are diametrically opposed to mine. And so I've gotten into some very long discussions with these people. And, you know, so I talk to everybody. I talk to also, you know, Palestinians who are very much on the other end, extreme. Very few, I've got to say. I'm sure there are Palestinian extremists out there. I've really almost met none. I've got to say, everybody I meet is extremely reasonable. But, you know, I've had one or two exchanges with people who, you know, so on both sides.
Well, yeah.
And I believe in everything in between. One of the things that I hope that we'll get to doing is start to break up this spectrum into identifiable segments, because we have different groups and they need to be messaged differently and reached differently. So I can give some examples, but back to what you're saying about preaching to the choir, that's true. People get into closed groups. One reason they do is because when you open the groups, go to Naomi Wolf's wall and look at some of the, and she tries so hard to keep her wall, you know, respectful. And I mean, it can be really a free-for-all. And this is a very polemical issue. People really, really get extremely, I'm searching for the words, maybe you can help me, but you know, the conversations get extremely raw around this subject.
Yeah.
So I can understand people wanting to talk about it in a safe environment with people that they sort of agree with, because it really is not your average. And the other thing is about people's walls. So many people come up to me and say, you know, I can't put this on my wall because I have, you know, Jewish friends or Jewish family or Jewish this or that. And it's not all Jewish people, but you get these reactions. I know I get reactions. I think what people mostly do on my wall is they disagree with me. They may turn off my notifications or they just ignore me. You know, but they don't engage me. But people get engaged, and they do, and it can be unpleasant. I've got to, you know, let's be honest here. These discussions can be very difficult.
If you're not prepared,
you need to really be prepared. You're almost trained to have these discussions in a productive way.
That's it. Somebody who really, you know, like I never studied debating, and now I wish I would have. When you're talking about different groups need to be reached in different ways, this is so true. My dear friend, Sarit Jacobson, who actually served in the IDF for 3 months until she got herself removed several years ago.
Excellent.
She lives, in the U.S. now. And she speaks Hebrew, of course, and she goes into the Hebrew group and just tries to talk. And, you know, she's had so many death threats and, you know, what
exactly
this thing, of course, because, you know, people are somewhere else and she's here. But she has, it's always like we just practically celebrate when somebody gets it, somebody who isn't being necessarily rude to her, but says, you know, she's all wrong and on, and she starts talking to them, maybe sending them off to some videos, you know, this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're seeing and hearing things they've never seen before.
Exactly. And there you go. And that's where we get into segments,
you
know, Ruthann, because it depends on who you're talking to. There are people, there are Jewish people, you know, in the U.S. and non-Jewish people who are simply misinformed.
Yes.
And when you start, and what started me, if you noticed, was Israelis. Listening to and reading Israelis who were opposed the occupation.
Yes.
And extremely, just the most wonderful, Miko Peled, and I'll say again, Ilan Pape, Gideon Levy, Amira Haas, Miko Peled, all of these wonderful, wonderful people, brilliant, knowledgeable, and I could go on with the names, but these are the people who sold me. That's where I got started. And of course, the other thing is going. Because there's nothing like seeing it with your own eyes and realizing that this has all been hidden from you.
Yeah.
That's, even the images. Mm-hmm.
Well, and like you said, I mean, everybody's doing it differently. I have a very good friend who's American, Jewish man, and he's hitting the synagogue. He's doing a one-on-one. I mean,
right.
He starts talking to people there. And he's... You know, he's got a few of those looks and a few words, but this is the way, because he's very good speaking and he really cares about people, and he's just trying to, one person at a time.
Exactly.
So, you know, everybody has their own way, but it's like, you know, whatever your way is, do it. And
I agree with, look, one-on-one, it has its place. I do some of that too. You know, but more and more I realize I don't want to, especially, it depends on who you're debating. If you're talking to somebody who you really think you can convince, that may be worth a one-on-one.
Right.
But if it's somebody who you know that, you know, you can put all the facts in front of them, they'll never change.
Right.
And believe me, there is plenty of that. There are people who are not, their opinions are not based on, as we see with other issues, it's not only this.
Oh, no.
But, you know, it's not rational. It's not about facts and argument. They will never change their opinion. So the only value, there are two values. One is it's kind of a training. So sometimes I do it kind of for fun to work on my, you know, ability to engage.
I know.
And, you know, when you're in the mood, because it takes some energy to it, you can get sick of it. And then the second reason, Ruthann, is that when you do it publicly, in front of others, then it takes on a different dimension. Because if, especially when you're with a real loon, I mean, some of these settlers, for example, you know, somebody who's really extreme, these views are not seen by most Americans. They don't know that this kind of, what we've got to call this extreme right-wing nationalism,
yeah,
exists in Israel, or even among Jewish people elsewhere. They don't know about this. So when they see this, and they see a more reasonable person giving reasonable arguments, and they see that exchange, I think it has a huge effect on the third party. So I believe in engaging publicly with those kind of people,
yeah,
but not privately.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I'm all for one-on-one, if whatever, but like you say, if you think you have a chance, and if you're just in the mood.
But exactly.
If it's just banging your head against the wall, you know, I personally am sure you don't have the energy for this. I mean, the energy can be better spent doing almost anything else. So that's a judgment call. But if somebody, you know, is getting it from their family, well, why are you spending so much time doing this and this? You know, you might take the time and talk to them.
Oh, yeah. And, look, let me tell you something else very quickly that I'm seeing amazing things. I'm seeing friends of mine, Jewish friends, really changing the way I changed 5 years ago with Kaplan and my Jewish Palestine. I'm seeing these changes. People are affected. And when you start to see a John Stewart or a Naomi Wolf or many of these other, you know, well-known Jewish people out there who are standing up and going with their ideals rather than with this particular affiliation or whatever you would call it. Naomi Wolf is a fantastic example. I'm going to be name-dropping and maybe, you know, giving people some hints of places they might want to go.
Exactly.
Naomi Wolf's page is amazing for a few reasons, very quickly. One, when I talked about the surge of connectivity, which I think is going to be looked back on and people are going to write PhD theses and books about it and stuff, I think something is really happening here. And Naomi was a big part of it. And her membership went from less than 2 million to more than 4 million in 2 or 3 weeks.
Wow.
And God knows where it is now because it's been a while since I saw that. So that's one thing to know, that, you know, she got swept up in the surge along with other people. And two, she's doing something absolutely fascinating. She's using Facebook, she's using this format of the public page to do participatory citizens journalism. She's directing people, she's saying, go get me a second source on this, and go look into that, and she's actually got them working like a kind of a newsroom. And it's absolutely fascinating. So that was one of the inspirations, I think, because there you go, it's a production-oriented, action-oriented, results-oriented way of using Facebook. And so I think that was one of the big inspirations behind Humanity for Palestine as well. And the last thing about Naomi is that she was a so-called Zionist. We could unpack that later if you're interested in those kinds of terms. I think that she probably would have called herself a Zionist. She was somebody who never looked at Israel, never questioned it. She lived there for 2 years, speaks fluent Hebrew. I mean, she's a practicing, you know, she's a practicing Jew, et cetera. I mean, this is somebody who has a strong Jewish identity and who never, you know, looked critically at Israel. And yet she has all of this experience of looking critically at everything else. And what you see if you go to her page and start going back over the last 2 or 3 months is a document of her awakening over this issue.
Isn't that wonderful?
She started from point A and now she's at Z. And you watch it step by step. So it's absolutely a fascinating document, you know, her Facebook page.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I mean, and that's it. Because we do need people like the men that you were talking about before. And, you know, people who are names, because they get our attention. And somebody might, like, you read them. You read Gideon Levy and,
yes,
you know, when you were starting to see what was happening. So anytime we can get somebody who's written the book or, you know, something like that, that we already know of, and we think what they're saying about this topic.
Exactly. Exactly. This is, in other words, somebody like Ilan Pappé, Gideon Levy, whatever, you're going to hear about them because of this.
Yeah.
But Naomi is somebody we've known for years talking about other things.
Right.
And she purposefully, I mean, whether it was, I don't know, she talks about this too on her page, you know, to what extent it was unconscious or what have you. She always avoided looking at this.
Right, in denial, like a lot of people. And like you said, I mean, she even lived there and
correct.
Didn't see or wasn't aware. I have a good friend in Jerusalem, and he's not Orthodox, but he's called a religious Jew, and he thinks that this is all horrible, but I can't really talk to him because he puts everything back to the Torah, and if he were Christian, it would be the end of this, whatever. He's waiting for this. And, I mean, he thinks that what's happening in Gaza is absolutely horrible.
Right.
But he thinks it has to happen.
Mm.
See, so he's got that kind of a mindset.
Interesting.
A man who is a good man. I mean, he really is. But because of the way his religious views are, it's just like, okay, we've just got to get through it.
Got it.
Thing. So
very interesting. So this would consider part of a Jewish religious view that he has?
He is. He considers himself a religious Jew and his family. And but not Orthodox. There's a difference. And we know that we've seen a lot of the Orthodox Jews are
correct.
Protesting against this. And they're saying that in the Torah, it says, or the Talmud, it says that the Jewish people should not have a land of their own.
Exactly.
And so they've been, you know, fighting. And then, of course, because the young men don't want to go into the service, there's all of that. We've interviewed, Sarit and I have interviewed some of the Israelis and who are fighting for Palestine, and the things they do, and the arrests and the beatings.
Yeah.
It's horrible. People don't understand that. So when people make
exactly
about all those Jews and blah, 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 and Israel, you know, I get quite upset because we're talking about a Zionist entity pretty much, and people who have been propagandized to death.
Right.
So,
well, and there I think we can unpack that a little, you know, talking about Jews and Zionists and all these things. What is all of this and how do we think about it? I think that maybe we'll stop for a second on that. But I do want to say that, I do want to drop another name. Breaking the Silence are the people, and you just go to, you know, type in Breaking the Silence in your address bar, get their website. They produce books and videos and all kinds of long interviews. They've done all kinds of things. They give tours in the West Bank, and they're not the only ones.
Yeah, we talk about Breaking the Silence a lot, Sarit and I, because now these heroes we're talking about, they really are.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, that's they're people who did things that they're so ashamed about now, but they
exactly
want to bring it out. They want people to know what's going on. So,
exactly, and when you see their, you know, when you see these interviews and you see this, you know, they did something and they went through the process of first being in denial about what they did, then questioning it, and finally having remorse, and then finally wanted to do something about it. So going through this change, this is very human. This is an awakening process. It's a process of personal growth, as opposed to the person who does things and doesn't even, you know, never looks back and never questions what they did. So it's quite amazing to see these people, yes.
Yeah, and, well, you know, the thing is, and I think that's why a lot of people in Israel and here and around the world for different areas of issues, whatever, keep themselves in denial because some part of them knows that once they accept that this is happening, once they come out and say, yes, this is horrible, that as a human being, it's the responsibility to do something.
Exactly.
And I think, like you were talking earlier, people feel so helpless. So this is also maybe a subconscious kind of thing going on, but it's like, well, I'm one person, I can't do anything, so I'm not going to even admit that this is happening. I'm just going to
exactly
watch some stupid show on TV and, you know, fog brain.
Correct, and we do it too. I mean, here in the United States, you know, God bless the United States, but the things that the U.S. has been doing and the level of denial about it, you know, it's not just, and we could go much farther. I mean, you know, there are many things that go on. You know, people eat meat, there's the industrial meat system, awful things, and we just kind of, it's kind of a plague of our time to dissociate our own actions and responsibility from what's happening around us. For example, often, you know, the products that we buy, so when you buy something, whether it's supporting, you know, big meat, or whether it's supporting, you know, greenhouse gas producing companies, or whether it's supporting the Israeli apartheid, whatever it is, you are supporting that with your money. You're actually helping those people who are doing those things. And if we need to take responsibility, and I'll say that when I grew up, you know, when I was growing up, again, in, as I said, a largely but not completely Jewish environment, I would hear things like, people would say this, it's kind of hard for me to say it now, but it's true. They said there was no such thing as a good German. Yeah. You know, that's difficult for me to bring that out of my mouth because I think it's an awful thing to say, but there's a truth in it, which is what it's saying is, people close their eyes. They didn't do anything. Yes. And so, but how can we say that now when we are closing our eyes to so many things? And, you know, we are supporting actively and pretending that we're not.
Yeah, that's, and there again, people are just, they're in denial. And it's like, well, I've got to have some kind of something to feed my kid. And, you know, this, or I have to put clothes on the kid, and the only thing I can afford are these items that are made in Bangladesh where people get 45 cents something, and not in factories that catch fire and they burn to death. So people don't, they don't know how to do it. I mean, you know, one thing I just say, because I'm into living the simple life, not being a big consumer kind of thing, it's like, you know, there again, your money just talks. And so many people in the U.S. particularly have so much that they don't need. You know, they don't need to go out and buy more. Food is an
exactly.
But, you know, other than that, you know, I think some of the happiest people on the planet, really, I think, are those who don't have a lot of material possessions to worry about.
Well, I spent time in African villages and all kinds of favelas and all those kinds of places. And I can tell you that, yeah, that's what you see. And, you know, and that's what you see is that happiness and material well-being are not exactly correlated.
Yeah.
There are other things more important. And especially when you get to the point that we're at, where you're way beyond your basic needs.
Right.
So more at that point isn't going to, you know, help you.
Well, that's,
I think you're exactly right. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I was just going to say that, you know, the U.S. has such a small population or percentage of the world population, and yet we use up something like 40% of the natural resource of the world.
Exactly. Let's see, I'm trying to remember some of the numbers. You know, the average American uses as much energy as the average, as 50 Ethiopians, I think we produce a quarter of the greenhouse gases, all of those things. Yeah, you know, when you look at waste, the amount of solid waste we produce.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right,
exactly.
And food. We waste 40%. 40% of the food that, just like that, that the ordinary person buys, they waste.
Exactly. So,
oh, my goodness. I mean, that's just...
Exactly. But again, this is a loss of responsibility. We have lost a sense of responsibility.
Yes.
There was a time when, you know, your parents would teach you to be responsible for your actions or whatever. You know, there used to be this ethic, and it's really disappearing. People do not have any sense of the consequences of their actions, especially when they're material transactions, as if a material transaction absolves you of the responsibility for what it is you're supporting with your money.
Exactly. Well, I paid for it. You know, that's it. So whoever had to do whatever to get this to me doesn't matter because I just laid out some cash for it.
Exactly.
It's mine, I deserve it.
Exactly. And that gets back, now, tying it back in, because this does connect with Humanity for Palestine, and it connects with the whole movement, the pro-Palestine movement, in several ways. One is it's about taking responsibility. So the boycott movement, for example, what we realize is Israel is only able to do this because of external support, and especially because of U.S. support.
Yeah.
If they didn't have the veto in the Security Council, if they didn't have the $3.5 billion a year, if they didn't have all kinds of things that they get from the U.S., they would not be able to do this. They would be forced, like the South Africans were, to find a more just solution.
Yes.
But they don't have to do it now because they're being protected. So our job as Americans, this is actually the place to make the change.
Yes.
It can't happen there. And, I'll throw in that when I was there, the last time I was in Palestine was late 2012, so a year and a half ago, I guess. What is it? A year and a half ago, about. And so December 2012, and people were so pessimistic. You know, all the Palestinians I knew were just, you know, it's kind of despair. What can you do? We can't do anything. You know, we're powerless. Again, the powerlessness and helplessness. Israel is so powerful. And I started saying to them, you know, things are changing. People are paying attention. People are starting to change their attitudes about this. And that was then. Of course, it's much more now. And they would be like, really, you think? You know, that there was like a glimmer of hope. That's what they need.
Yes.
Is to see. And let me tell you something else that I've been talking the last few days. You know, I'm in touch with people in Gaza. And a lot of my friends are on phone calls. I was chatting with a young man in Gaza just when the bombing started. What was that, the day before yesterday? I've lost my sense of time lately with all this.
I know. Yeah.
But, you know, I'm talking to him, and I found out that the bombing had started. And I said, hey, did the bombing start? And he said, oh, yeah, 7 minutes ago. And then, you know, we exchanged a few more words, and he said, I've got to get out. You know, I've got to take my father and get out of here. And this is what we're dealing with. And these people are so nice. He thanked me. You know, he said, look, if you don't hear from me again, I just wanted to thank you for what you're doing.
Oh, my God,
And I said, stop that. You're going to hear from me. You know, you're going to. But, I mean, this is what you're dealing with. People cannot imagine. And the people are so nice.
Yes. That, I've gathered that even though I haven't been there. But the people, they seem like a breed above, a cut above somehow. I mean, they really, really are nice. And you know how they want us to visit, and it's not just so we can come back and tell people. They just want us to visit.
Exactly.
You know? I mean, these people who have not much, I mean, we know the food is and electricity 6 hours a day and no good water.
But, yeah, well, that's Gaza. I mean, the West Bank is a little better. But,
yeah, the West Bank is better. But they're very hospitable.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's for such people, well, for anybody to be under this kind of stress, it's a crime, a sin, whatever you...
Yeah. They give you stuff. I mean, people, Palestinians were giving me gifts, you know, and this is, it's not me, like, everyone. I know so many people from all around the world, from Australia, from England, from, you name it, South America, who went to Palestine and who fell in love the same way I did. And I'm going to plug another book. My friend Pamela Olson wrote a book called Fast Times in Palestine, which is her story of sort of stumbling into the West Bank and falling in love with it. Fast Times in Palestine, Pamela Olson. And she's somebody else you can follow on Facebook who's doing great work, again, following the event, great analysis. And I could name more names of people like that who went through the same experience. They never imagined the situation these people are living in, the walls, the checkpoints, you know, everything they have to go through. It's unbelievable. But also, they had no idea what wonderful people these were. So everybody falls in love, and they sort of feel compelled, you know, responsible for giving back and doing something. And so that's my case, but the case of many.
Yeah. Well, that was what Sarit says when she lived there, and she had met some Bedouins, and she stayed with them sometimes. And she said they were just fantastic.
Mm.
I mean, they would do anything for you.
Exactly.
And, you know, this kind of thing, even though they didn't have hardly anything, but it's a whole other mindset. But I think you find that sometimes when people are put upon and in this type of situation, they're good. I think people are inherently good. I mean, I can't help it. I'm the optimist kind, but I think people are. And that's why I keep saying, if people really knew what's happening,
exactly,
and really believed us about what's happening.
Well, look, our media has tried to divide us. You know, the politics, they try to create these divisions that we know so well. And you know, different whatever kinds of divisions they can make, really, it doesn't matter. I mean, the whole Sunni-Shia thing didn't exist. I mean, people are like, oh, it's millennial. It's been happening forever. Yeah, go find all the Sunni-Shia wars in history.
Yeah.
And go find all the bloodshed between Jews and Arabs in the Arab world for the last 1,300 years. I mean, it just doesn't exist.
No, no.
And, you know, so there's a lot of, you know, distortion of history. There's a lot of attempt to divide people. Everywhere I go, and Ruthanna, I've traveled a lot.
It sounds like, yeah.
I've spent a lot of time in, many places. Even in my work, I've been really all over, you know, Asia, Africa, South America, the Caribbean, et cetera. And, you know, I don't find these bad people. You know, I've been to Egypt, I've been to Palestine, where are the bad people? Like, I don't see them when I go. I talk to the taxi drivers, I talk to, you name it. So, you know, that gets back to the name Humanity for Palestine. I think that there's a point here. One is that we're not against anything. This is not anti-Israel. Being for Palestine does not mean that you're against Israelis or certainly a Jewish people, for example.
Yeah.
Second of all, it's about humanity. This is not about Palestine against Israel. This is about, you know, this is about a humanist perspective as against a tribalist myopic perspective. This is really, if we're against something, I would say it's the idea of identifying oneself with some group, whatever it is, and believing that you have more in common with that group than with the rest of humanity. And all of the people we're working with now, I'm telling you, they're from all over the world. I mean, they're from Europe, they're from Southeast Asia, they're from Australia, they're from South America, you know, they're from the Middle East, etc. And everybody's working together with this, you know, this vision is clear. It's shared by everyone. You don't see anybody saying, oh, well, you're from here and you're from there. There's none of that. In fact, I don't even know. Sometimes they'll be like, oh, you're Palestinian? I mean, I don't know who's Palestinian. I don't know who's Israeli. I don't ask.
No.
But people are from everywhere. And, you know, and I think that is the emergent spirit. And we see it in our group, but I know that it's not just in our group. You know, this is what people want now, is to break out of this kind of parochial, this, you know, this small-minded way of looking at ourselves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Within such a narrow little box with the blinders or something.
Exactly.
And really, and we know that the world, at this point, there's big transformations going on with our planet.
Mm-hmm.
And the vibratory levels are changing. People are opening up more, reassessing their own lives, and doing that makes them, you know, open to more other things. So I think
that's right.
It's a great time to be alive. And
well,
it's
certainly not boring.
No, not boring. And sometimes, sure, it gets frustrating or something. I mean, it's just like, oh my goodness, why can't they, you know? But it's, I'm just saying, okay, go take a walk, get online, go do something, and you know, just clear your mind, because people have to stay healthy mentally and physically to do what needs to be done. So.
Exactly. No, and that's a huge part of it, is working on yourself, realizing that the fault is not with the other guy. You know, it's not the moat or whatever, you know, the dye in his eye. I mean, but this is really that we have to look at ourselves, that the ills in the world are only a manifestation of the ills within us.
Exactly.
That it's that these horrible slaughters going on, and you know, we're not denying this, what's going on in Iraq or Syria or Congo or Ukraine, or I mean, you know, it's all awful. And all of this, you know, when you look at your own life, and you know, maybe you had a fight with somebody, and then you know, whatever, and it's not, you know, you're driving, and then you get into a shouting match, whatever it is that your little things are at work, and you multiply it by a few million, and that's it. It's the same energy,
yeah.
You know, but you multiply that by a few million, and you start to see very terrible things.
Exactly, and then though, you know, there are many different groups now who are having like world meditations at a certain time and this kind of thing, and I really suggest that people get in on some of that. It actually works, because energy is energy, and when you're sending it for certain things,
exactly,
and you may sometimes you see results right away, sometimes you don't, but it's working because it's energy. So
I do believe that. You know, I'm going to plug another name, probably shouldn't because it has nothing to do with this, but right before all this started, or it was actually Gaza was already going on, but before the organization started, I went to a retreat with Eckhart Tolle, and it was amazing, I've got to say.
Yep.
And to me, like, yes, that embodies the kind of spirit, and there are many ways that you can call it or think about it or whatever, but I think everybody in their own way, whatever religion is, et cetera, it's not a religious question exactly. It's deeper than that. It's about your personal attitude. And I think that is penetrating, and the fact is that is the only thing that's going to keep us from true disaster.
Yes.
Because we're all focused on Gaza, and Gaza is terrible, and there are other terrible things, but we've got some big, big problems coming up.
Exactly. Exactly. The climate change is alive and well. And, you know, if we don't take care of things like that, whatever we do about Gaza isn't going to matter.
in a few decades, you know, there will be, you know, that whole area will be uninhabitable, for example. It won't matter who wins.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's right. There's major, major issues. We only have, Peter,
right,
3 minutes left now, because we're only doing this for an hour. So what would you like to close with?
Boy, you know, I guess I just say that this has been just an incredible experience. I know that I feel like we're a little piece. Humanity for Palestine is a little piece of something much bigger that's going on. And as you've been saying, Ruthanne, you know, so correctly, it goes beyond that. It's much bigger. Yes, we're focused on Gaza and Palestine. We want justice. We want peace. And we're not going to give up, you know, just because there's a ceasefire. We know that the situation is intolerable. And we're going, just like the Gazans, we're going for the whole thing. We want peace and justice. But at the same time, we're aware of the bigger picture. And I think that what you're seeing is a mobilization on a very broad, on a planetary scale, that is starting to emerge. And very much as you said, it has to do with a change in consciousness about, and I think that this identification with small groups is really a thing of the past, and that this emergent consciousness is what we're seeing. And so it's been wonderful. I'm seeing people killing themselves night and day. You know, we don't get a penny. I mean, this is, people are just donating their time. It's incredible.
Exactly.
And they're all thanking each other. So, you know, anybody who's interested, go to Humanity for Palestine is the page, and the group is still called Peter Cohen. That one day we're going to, you know, change it for some reason. But my little group, so, you know, go there and join it and come see us there.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you, Peter, and thank you for having this vision and following through. You know, they say a lot of people have visions, but it doesn't matter because they never do anything with them. You have. I thank you so much, my friend. Thank you.
Talk soon.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.